Ah, the start of the week and plenty on the radio to get your attention. Adopting a baby as a single person, a life-changing burglary and phone scams. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
At the end of it, she said, "You probably want to know what's wrong." I said, "Yes, I do, please." Well, she said, "I'm here to tell you there is nothing wrong, but I'm here to confirm to you that you are transgender female."
Yeah, I just can't wait now for things to hopefully go back to normal. I guess it takes that worry out of just day-to-day life of afraid of bringing something home or giving something to someone else, so...
Paul was the brave one and asked the question, did they think the people would have been prepared to use those weapons? And the guard just said, absolutely, you know, absolutely, you had a lucky escape.
And we'll start here in the afternoon on Liveline. Dara called Katie Hannan about working as a taxi driver and dealing with traffic issues. But later in the conversation, Dara told Katie about the current changes happening in his personal life.
Dara, you mentioned there that you were on your way to a psychologist when you were listening to us on Friday. And I know people might know your name actually from Britain's Got Talent and other places. And you have a lot going on in your life right now, Dara.
And incidentally, I'm the last person to have performed the national anthem in Croke Park when Dublin were last beaten in the All-Ireland Championship. That was 2014.
And I was in Croke Park.
Yeah, but there is a lot going on in my life.
We'll explain to people where you're coming from. Should take us right back to the start, Dara.
Yeah, I suppose, look, when I was growing up, certainly in my early years of 7, 8, 9, I always knew there was something wrong. I felt so different. Now, I went to an all-boys primary school, but I used to get bullied a lot. I used to be called sissy a lot, and I never understood what it meant, and I felt I couldn't come home and talk about it. But when I went into my puberty years, that's when it really hit home. I absolutely hated everything that was going on, the physical changes and all that, and I started to self-harm. I hated my body, I hated me. I knew there was something wrong, but I didn't know who to talk to, and I certainly didn't feel I could talk to my mum, because I would have come from a very religious family. And it just kept building and building. I went to train to be a priest for a year when I finished secondary school. That wasn't for me at all. Again, I was in an all-male surrounding, and yet I still knew there's something not right.
And when you say, what year are we talking about now? Are we talking back in the 90s?
Yeah, we're back in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm 48 now.
Okay, so there would have been very little discussion in media or in culture generally about this kind of an issue.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, we only have to go back to 1993. Prior to that, homosexuality was an offence. And that's only one side of LGBTQI and all that community. Mm. Yeah, there was nothing at all ever mentioned about anything to do with that. I do recall the term transvestite being mentioned. Again, I didn't really understand what that meant. Now, later on, as I discovered what it meant, I knew that wasn't me. This isn't a temporary thing for me at all. And I remember chatting to Ryan Tuberty a couple of years ago, and I was talking to him about my mental health. And I had actually planned my own suicide the day after my 20th birthday. And if I'm truly honest, that was the reason, because I felt so trapped inside. I just felt I can't deal with this pain. I can't cope. Nobody will understand. There's nobody to go and talk to. And I just planned to get out.
And what stopped you? What saved you?
It sounds so simple yet profound. On my birthday, another RTÉ broadcaster, Alf McCarthy, was broadcasting from the Cork studios. And somebody, I don't remember who, but somebody sent in a request for Dara McGann for his birthday. And he played Matt Monro singing The Impossible Dream. I actually listened to that entire song, and it was that song that actually saved my life. There was a line in that song, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. It just struck with me that day, maybe this is it, I'm actually in hell at the moment. And if I can get through another day or another day, I'll get into that heavenly cause. It seems simple now, but that's what actually got me through and helped me not to go through what I had planned.
And then Dara told Katie about another turning point in his life.
I would say I'm going back to about 2009. That was around the time that I had been on the Show Igas show on RTE, and I met with somebody in Dublin who was in the transgender community. And she gave me an opportunity to come to Dublin and get all dressed up to go out. But the thing is, once I saw myself, all makeup and everything, I fell on the floor in tears. I was crying my heart out because I was finally seeing me. And the person I always knew was there. You see, I used to always wear a facial beard because I couldn't bear to look at myself in the mirror because I could see the woman looking back at me, and it just caused so much pain. After that experience, I got with a clinical psychologist in Clonakilty who specialises in gender issues. And my first encounter with her would be about 12 years ago now. And I remember that first hour with her, I cried my heart out. And at the end of it, she said, "You probably want to know what's wrong." I said, "Yes, I do, please." Well, she said, "I'm here to tell you there is nothing wrong, but I'm here to confirm to you that you are transgender female." Katie, to hear that, those words coming out to me, knowing that I wasn't crazy, I wasn't going mad, that was just a liberation in itself.
And you knew that was it. That was putting a name on what you had felt for all those years.
Oh yeah, I knew, but it was to get that sort of like a clinical diagnosis for whatever your illness is, but it's not an illness. But just for that to be confirmed to me, it made me feel complete to a point. I knew there was further steps to take, but just to hear that was just amazing.
What, like, again, yeah, I cannot imagine, actually. It's such a profound moment for you. But you must have also known at that moment, that you were now going to be embarking on a very challenging journey.
I did, and I knew that the biggest issue that I had, and I don't mean say this in a negative way or in a bad way, but it was my mum, because I live with her, I care for her, and I didn't know how she might react. And that fear of not knowing how she would react actually, put me back in, to use that term, the closet again.
Yeah.
Even though I kept attending the psychologist, I attended her for 10 years straight, once a month. And that kept me grounded. But I knew I couldn't transition. Well, I felt I couldn't transition, that mum mightn't accept or my family mightn't accept.
And had you had any kind of attempt to broach this with your mom at this stage?
I tried to broach the subject a few years back, but once it got to the crucial stage, I chickened out. And mom had been going through a period of ill health, and I just felt, no, I can't do this to her. So then I had made my mind up, right, you know what, I know who I am. I'm not going to do anything until she passes, because I don't think she could cope. How wrong I was. Because last August, we did a staycation in Kerry for a few days. I don't know, I can't put my finger on it, but something changed during those few days where I felt, you know, maybe she is ready to hear this. So we came home, I went to see my GP, who was her GP, and, of course, with the face covering on, you can't see a person's expression. But as I was telling him the story, I could see him smiling. I said, "Doctor, what are you smiling at?" He said, "You're doing great." I said, "Doctor, tell me. Dara, I know you all my life. I've always known you were transgender, but professionally, ethically, I couldn't tell you. Why did it take to this stage? Excuse me. And I said, I'm worried about Mum. He said, what are you worried about? Sure, she knows. I came home that morning. I sat down with her. I said, I have something to tell you, Mum. I should have dealt with this a long time ago. And I started into my story, and I could see her smiling and her eyes welling up. And she said, Dara, do you not see the weight lifting off my shoulders? I always knew this about you since you were a child. But you must understand, she said, in the 80s, the 90s, even the early noughties, who could I talk to? Who could I go and say something to? They'd think I was crazy.
That's Dara on the live line with Katie Hannan. And if you're affected by any of these issues, rte.ie/helplines. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, Ryan was marking the 50th anniversary of the death of Jim Morrison.
50 years after he died, Jim Morrison continues to attract big numbers to his grave in Père Lachaise. I visited his grave in Père Lachaise years ago, 122 years ago, before he was even born. And I remember spotting people had put cigarette butts in the grave and there were bottles of booze. Like, they're feeding him. I'm sure he needed that like a hole in his head. But anyway, he was found dead on July 3rd, 1971 in a bathtub. Never performed an autopsy, and people dispute whatever happened to him. He was one of that 27 club, wasn't he? He was age 27, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix and Kurt Cobain and Brian Jones and Amy Winehouse. Wouldn't that be, if she's in there too? Desperate. Anyway, so people still go there to Père Lachaise. If you've never been to Père Lachaise, if you ever happen to get to Paris, it is as cemeteries. I think cemeteries are very, very eerily beautiful. And there's some beautiful artwork, and particularly in that one, I think Oscar Wilde's there as well. There's heaps of them, but we have our own Glasnevin, so you don't need to go to Paris. But it's quite the place. But yeah, people brought candles and pictures and incense sticks and the whole lot, because it is a place of worship for fans of the Doors.
And then Kathy called the show from Paris.
I live opposite where Jim Morrison passed away.
Oh my goodness, in the bathtub, as they said, sadly, yes, and at the age
apparently.
Of 27. And yes. Is it a busy spot? Is it a place, a refuge for fans?
It's a quiet little street, and there is quite a discreet passage most days of fans just stopping and having a look up at the building and taking photos.
So you can see it. You can see it from. Are you in an apartment there, take it in France, in Paris?
Yes, right opposite, yeah.
I'd say it's beautiful, is it? Would that be fair to say?
It's in the Marais, which is right in the centre of Paris, near Bastille. So, yes, it's
beautiful.
Very nice.
Gorgeous, the architecture and the vibe and the ambience and everything is just gorgeous. And tell me this,
yes.
Well, have you been to Père Lachaise?
Yes. I brought the kids for the first time that they'll sort of really remember, maybe. And we had a little a trip around Père Lachaise during the last holidays.
And who did you see there, if you know what I'm saying? Who did you?
Well, yeah, I tried to make a little list for them. It was based mostly around music. So we went and we saw Jim Morrison. We saw Oscar Wilde. We saw BJ. Let me think. I made a little playlist on Spotify for them. Yeah.
You made it like a grave list.
Yeah, the Père Lachaise visit list, yeah.
Come on, who else did you go and see?
I'm trying to think now, who else did we see? It was based Chopin.
Great.
So it was mostly around music. So yeah, Edith Piaf.
Oh,
so I made them a little playlist of, and they had a map, so they had to go and pick out all the different spots, and then they listened to a little bit of music when we got to each spot. So yeah, it was really good.
What a brilliant, brilliant way of doing a graveyard with your kids. No, but that really brings history alive. I love that. That's a great idea. And if ever I go to Père Lachaise again, I'm going to do exactly that. Do a Père Lachaise, dead people singing and talking and dancing and whatever it is. That's so good because it's such a beautiful cemetery and it's such a celebration of it.
It's such a super place. It really is. It's not in the least bit sad. It's really beautiful. Yeah. It's a super big park, and yeah, nice walk. You can spend the whole day there. And we've been back a few times, and we're going back again the next time to do. We did another Egyptian symbology tour where they had to go and pick out different Egyptian symbols on different tombs and stuff. So yeah, you can just go back so many times.
I'm sold. I'm ready. As soon as the planes are up in the air again, I'll be there.
What a genius idea. That's Kathy in Paris from the Ryan Tiberty Show. And on the Ray Darcy Show, I've been getting calls from the Garda Síochána. That's a scam. And Conor Pope was talking about the common phone scams currently doing the rounds.
I was saying at the beginning of the show that I think that these scam calls, texts, emails are reaching an epidemic proportion. Do you think so? You wrote about it over the weekend, the Irish Times.
I did, yeah. And it's no coincidence that they're getting so prolific now. And that's simply because they're so simple to do. So part of the piece that we did in the Irish Times on Saturday was to explain to people just how these scam phone calls operate. Because a lot of people think that there's a genuine 083 or 087 number behind the call, and there actually isn't. So what these criminals are doing is they're using spoof software that they can download incredibly easily off the internet for free, right, to mask their actual identity and mask their actual number, and then they flood a network, be it Vodafone or Three or Virgin or Air, with hundreds of thousands of calls. And the people think it's coming from an 087 number or an 083 number, but it's actually coming from a number outside of this jurisdiction. And then they press 1 and then the scam begins. But the reason why there's such a proliferation is, A, because the scam artists are aware of the fact that people are more anxious and they're nervous because of the pandemic. And that's not just in this country, it's worldwide. But the second reason is it's just so simple for them to do. And if they send out 100,000 phone calls or 500,000 phone calls and two people are duped, well, then it makes sense for them. So it's really easy, and it's a very low level risk for them as well, because it's an international cross-border kind of crime.
Yeah. The thing that struck me with your article was how easy it is. I had this notion that they needed very well-educated, you know, computer software people, but they don't.
No, and actually it used to be that way. And that's why, you know, these kinds of spoofing scams would have been extremely rare in the past, because it was difficult. You needed to have brains, whereas now you just need to have a criminal mindset, and you can do it.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting that I was looking at some of the figures internationally, and in the United States, around $30 billion every year is lost to these scam artists. And in Australia, around $850 million is lost to these kind of scams. And there's no hard data about how much money is being lost in Irish context, but we're no different from the Australians and the Americans and the English and the Germans. And people are being duped every single day. And that's why the proliferation is just going to get worse and worse and worse. And one of the things I put to the industry people I spoke to was, like, why can't we have a system in place for our phone calls? Whereby, you know, in the past, we were all bombarded with spam messages from sub-Saharan princesses with suitcases full of blood diamonds. And then the technology was put in place so that all of that stuff was just filtered into our spam folders, and you never get to see it anymore.
Why can't we do the same for phones?
Because what happens is these guys, the software is so easy to use and so easy to tweak that they might start calling Ray Darcy on 087-291-29129 or whatever.
Yeah.
And then 2 minutes later, just when the network has twigged that there's an issue, they'll switch the number, change it by one, and start calling me. And me and 10,000 other people. And then just as the networks tweak that this number is dodgy, they change to another one and another one. So it becomes this ridiculous game of high-tech or low-tech cat and mouse. And it's very difficult for the networks
I'm looking at the numbers here that happened to me one day there recently, the 18th and the 6th.
Yeah.
So there's 1, 2, 3, 4 different numbers. The first one is 085, the second one's 087, 087, 087. And they're all within an hour.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as I say, and the other thing to put people's minds at ease is they don't have your number. So a lot of people thought, is this anything to do with the HSE ransomware attack?
They don't have your number.
They basically are just using robocalls, like computers, to call 50,000 random numbers that start with the prefix 087.
Okay. That's reassuring in a way.
And every now and then they'll hit the right number.
Yeah.
And then every now and then when they hit the right numbers, they'll hit somebody who's concerned.
Yeah, but they do so many. All they need is a small percentage hit. That's and exactly they make it. Money from that. Okay.
Conor Pope from The Ray Darcy Show. And in the afternoon, Sean called Katie about a theft in broad daylight.
Yeah, on the 26th of June, at about 10:30, I went up to the NCT Centre in Ballymun, Unit 2, parked my car in one of the bays, went in, paid the money, went back out to the car. I was WhatsApping, I'm on a WhatsApp group, I was WhatsApping a few mates, and then this chap came over to me, dressed like one of the testers, and he told me to move away from the car, to go over where all the other people were waiting. So I looked over, there was six or seven people waiting along a fence.
So hang on, Sean, now, when you say dressed like all the other testers, what were they wearing?
Yeah, he had a similar sort of jacket on him. I'm not saying he was a tester, but he was dressed like one, you know.
Right, okay.
Dublin accent, very casual, you know, very calm. So I went over to where everybody was, and again, I'm on the phone, didn't notice anything. And then just lucky enough, this chap that was waiting as well, he noticed something, and he went over to the car and called it to the attention of a tester. And when I seen this, I went over and I said, "Well, that's my car, what's going on?" And the chap that seen it said, "You want to get someone out here? I seen two lads at the car, they took something." So he looked underneath and he said, "They took the catalytic converter." I said, "You're joking me."
"No way."
So he said, "Yeah." He said, "A car pulled up, two lads jumped out, one of them jacked it up and the other cut it off with a grinder." He said, "It took about 30 seconds. He said, "That was it. They were gone."
So, and just to remind people, your car was actually parked in one of the bays outside the NCT Centre waiting to get called in for its test.
Yeah, in the compound, in a parking bay, yeah. It was shocking. I was astonished, you know.
That's Sean on the live line with Katie Hannon. And in the afternoon, on the News at One with Brian Dobson, people aged 18 plus now eligible to be vaccinated by their pharmacy.
Hundreds of pharmacies around the country have begun vaccinating people aged between 18 and 34 under the revised COVID immunisation plan announced last week. The decision allowing the single jab Janssen vaccine to be administered to the younger age groups is expected to speed up the vaccination rollout, with the HSE saying this weekend that all adults could be fully vaccinated within the next 2 months. The rollout, beginning from today, of the Janssen vaccine to the younger age groups was greeted with excitement and appreciation by those getting the vaccine, but with concern by pharmacists that the supply will fall far short of demand. Kian McCormack sent us this report.
Now, Pia, I'll just get you to fill out this consent form for the Janssen vaccine, please.
24-year-old Pia Deepman arrived at the Dunville Pharmacy in Ranelagh just after 10:20 this morning.
Now, Pia, we've all the paperwork done, so if you want to follow me into the consultation room and we'll get you started.
Her Janssen jab took about 2 seconds.
Right, Pia. It is as simple as that. That's you cool. Are done.
That's quick.
I know.
Afterwards, sitting on a bench in glorious sunshine, Pia waited for 15 minutes before she could go home.
Yeah, you probably can't see because of my face mask, but I can't stop grinning. Yeah, I just can't wait now for things to hopefully get back to normal.
When you say get back to normal, what do you expect now?
To be honest, I don't really know. Like, it changes all the time. I guess it takes that worry out of just day-to-day life of afraid of bringing something home or giving something to someone else. So,
what do you do in your normal life when you're not sitting outside a pharmacy post-vaccine? What is it that you do?
So I'm working at home now the whole time. So I actually finished college this time last year. So college from home and now working from home. So yeah, even just going back to the office would be something nice. That'd be a big thing for me.
Pia's brother, Hugo, who's 25, also got his vaccine.
Yeah, well, in terms of work, it means I get to go to the States. I'm looking after solar plants in Oregon and Maine in the US. So it's been, I suppose, I'm work managing them and I've never seen them, never been to a solar plant myself. So this gives me the opportunity to head out there, get a look around and meet my US colleagues that I've only met on Teams so far.
Your sister Pia was saying that for her it means she can meet friends, feel safer when she goes out, but also not worry about bringing the virus home. and meet older relations too.
Yeah, so I suppose one of the big things about this is now my grandma's from the Netherlands and she lives there. She's 89 or so, and I haven't been to see her in years. So yeah, it means I get to meet her.
That's really great, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
27-year-old Sean McGrath was the first person to get the Janssen vaccine at the Dunville Pharmacy this morning. Today means worries will disappear.
I guess it's good to, you know, just not have that worry kind of when you're meeting up with friends, and it's nice just to have that reassurance that, you know, you're going to probably be okay.
What about heading abroad?
I actually have plans to go abroad in a couple of weeks. It kind of worked out quite well with the COVID cert. I'll just be fully vaccinated by the time the COVID cert comes in.
Since the weekend, the Dunville Pharmacy has worked through a surplus of 35 Janssen vaccines remaining from the over 50s. Today, pharmacist Robert Falconer is concerned about the supply.
When I talked to Niamh Bowden here at Dunville Pharmacy on Friday, she had 500 people registered for the Janssen jab. What's it like today? How many people are on that list?
We are now in excess of 1,000. So the critical point will be supply of vaccines. Yep, so we're just waiting. I think the next delivery is on Wednesday. Niamh has requested a substantial amount. We'll see what arrives. Quite frankly, we never got enough flu vaccines, and we're hoping that the situation will be better this time round.
This is also a concern nationally. Dara O'Loughlin is Secretary General of the Irish Pharmacy Union.
Yes, that's typical. Almost every pharmacy that's involved in the programme has hundreds, if not thousands, of people trying to put their names down for appointments. I've had reports from all across Ireland, from large cities down to small towns, of pharmacists being inundated with people looking for the vaccine, particularly young people at the start of the summer who might want to work in hospitality or even travel this summer. And unfortunately, as things stand, supplies are very limited. And there are probably only is one vaccine for every 10 people looking for a vaccine this week.
What is the biggest challenge now as we go forward?
The biggest challenge now, given the number of people in that age group, is the shortage of vaccines. So supplies are very limited. There's about 10 people looking for a vaccine for every vaccine that pharmacists have available to them. More stock will come out towards the end of this week. The HSE will distribute more vaccines, and we're hoping that we'll get further supplies beyond that.
Cian McCormick's report for the News at One. Now, last week, Claire Byrne was talking to child psychologist Dr. David Coleman and dietitian Avian Bannon about the rise in eating disorders in children. This week, they answered questions from very concerned parents.
Dear David and Avian, my teenage son has a problem with his body image. He says he hates himself and that he's too thin. He's naturally very thin, it's in his genes, but he's healthy and very strong. He's obsessed with certain foods. To get as much protein as possible, he tends to eat one food non-stop and then go off it. He won't eat a balanced diet. The biggest problem is he won't talk to us. He won't eat meals with us. He's cut himself off. He says I'm a bad mother for not giving him enough protein. He wants meat at every meal and also outside of meals. He gets angry and aggressive if he's asked to help around the house or outside, and I'm now giving him whatever he asks for, even though it seems like a crazy diet, because he gets so angry and aggressive it's not worth it. I'm hoping he will eventually come to his senses, or that he will learn to accept himself and like himself. What should I do? Avian, do you want to start off on that one for us?
Yeah, this would be very, very typical and among kind of boys with teens, because obviously eating disorders can happen to boys just as well as girls. And there's a very much a focus on this kind of perception that if I have more protein, I will grow faster, grow muscles faster and develop faster. So what we would see with that would be kind of muscle dysmorphia, comparing themselves to some friends, not growing as quickly, not feeling as they're as strong, and then overdoing protein. And unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. A higher protein diet's not going to help any of that happen for them, but they end up displacing nutrition from other food by kind of targeting all protein foods. So really, often with boys like that, it might be best even to try and, say, bring him to a sports dietitian and try and kind of work on, we're going to help get you the sports help that you need to do this. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to help educate them as much as possible and understand they need a balanced diet to help kind of their body kind of grow naturally, because it will become more and more controlling. And then the more imbalanced the diet kind of becomes like an affected mood and it becomes this kind of cycle.
Okay, and David, what do you feel about that question from the listener? Because there's a behavioural issue in there as well, angry and aggressive if he's asked to help around the house.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, from what Aveen is saying, you know, it's clear obviously there's stuff to do with the food, but I think from my perspective, certainly I'd be looking at, well, what's going on in terms of the dynamic between the mum and the son? Because there's very definitely something about power within that, you know, whatever about the choices the son wants to make, how he's going about trying to make those choices certainly isn't effective. And yet there's the mum feeling so overwhelmed and almost afraid of the conflict with her son that she's pulling back and not necessarily sticking to what she believes in terms of, you know, her gut response to what her son needs. And so that's a dynamic I think that, you know, both of them need to work on. Typically, from my experience, you know, the son probably won't be motivated to do anything about that. And so the push to start to do something about it will probably have to happen with the mum first. But she may well want to talk to someone like me, you know, a psychologist, as well as talking to a dietitian, because, you know, they really need to think about, well, you know, how can they begin to work together? You know, whatever's going on for her son in terms of his perspective on food and his body and so on. You know, she needs to feel like she's not in conflict with him, that she's not fighting with him, but actually that she's able to support him.
And this question involved the complex issue of food phobias.
Here's a really tricky one, Aveen, and you might take this one for us, which has just come in on our text message. In relation to teenage eating disorders, I'd really like some advice. My 17-year-old son has what I think is called restrictive eating disorder. He only eats pizza, white bread and chicken munchies, only one brand. We've talked to him about broadening his selection, but he can't seem to be able to do it. He's an intelligent boy on the autistic spectrum, but is very high functioning. Please help guide us towards the best course of action.
Yeah, this is very hard for them because ARFID, that avoidant food restrictive intake disorder, which potentially that could be, we would perceive them to be, people say, fussy eaters, but they're not. They literally can't do it. They might want to try a food, but they can't. And there's a real fear of it, or how the texture will feel. It's usually a hypersensory issue. So the texture, the smell, the sight is much more prevalent even than the taste. So usually with that is a combination of kind of psychology, dietetics, and even sometimes occupational therapy or speech and language therapy to work on the sensory elements around the food. So what we would say for parents like that, if you're trying something, we do a thing called food chaining, whereby, for example, he eats pizza, you might try a different brand of pizza, or you might try then slightly less cheese, or you use the kind of safe food and then try variants of it. But you would trial them at a non-meal time when it's not a stressful or a kind of anxious time. Mm-hmm. Because when he gets a little bit older, he'll find it socially quite difficult to be out meeting friends, and he wants to eat, say, chicken wings, but he can't. He wants to, but he just literally can't. So it's trying to work in a food chaining journey to get there.
Okay, that sounds quite like a complex challenge, David. Mm.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, you know, the concept behind food chaining is based on kind of, you know, core behavioral principles, you know, which is building up associations. So, you know, he has very strong associations with the particular foods that he eats. And as Aveen is suggesting there, you know, probably is quite anxious about what other foods will be like, you know, without even necessarily trying them. So there's certainly work to be done in terms of his anxieties, you know, giving him strategies that he can feel that, you know, he can experience whatever the anxiety might be, because ultimately he is going to have to experiment a little bit with, you know, either variations on the food he's currently eating, moving then to ultimately trying new food. And so in order to feel like you can experiment, you have to have some strategies to feel like you can regulate your anxiety enough that it doesn't become overwhelming, in which case, you know, the avoidant stuff is what will come out again.
Okay, and I want to come to this one because we touched on veganism the last time you were in, Aveen,
yeah.
And it's really, really tricky because there is nothing wrong with someone deciding they want to be vegetarian or vegan.
Absolutely.
However,
yeah,
it can be misused, and this is perhaps an example of this. I'm the parent of a 16-year-old girl who since last November has become vegan. I totally respect her choice, but perhaps becoming vegetarian first might be better. Since Christmas, I've seen my beautiful daughter becoming thinner and thinner. She cooks her own meals, but will eat them with us. Her diet is now reducing to broccoli, falafel, chickpeas, crackers, hummus and gluten-free pasta. Everything has to be weighed and carefully planned out. She was diagnosed with a hiatus hernia in March because because she was suffering from reflux. Also, she hasn't had her period in over a year. They've kept the GP informed of the situation. Her and her daughter have discussed the issue. She's admitted that, yes, she does have a problem. This, to me, is a huge step. However, it's taking its toll on the family. She's begun food shaming her sister, who's 15, and the stress around food in the home is high. We were away recently, which was great, but we couldn't wait to get home because when we went out to eat, there was no vegan choice for her. The eating disorder was like another presence at the table, and she's also excessively exercising, walking for about 2 hours a day. And the questions this parent is asking is, what has triggered it? Social media? COVID? Am I to blame? We all worry about obesity, but the other end of the scale is frightening.
And I think, you know, you can't pick one thing because there's all these different elements in terms of what they're taught in school, and some of the programmes are quite kind of black and white versus food, social media, the kind of environmental thing. A lot of the vegan diets, if they go too far, can go very, very low in fat. She's got the over-exercise component in there too. I would definitely recommend for that mum that she looks into the Bodywise, do a really, really good pillar programme for parents that is free that they can sign up to. It's online at the moment. And it, any parents I know have done it have found it really, really incredibly supportive to help support their child. Even the fact she's cooking for herself, I would definitely try and incorporate a few kind of plant-based family meals in the diet. And that mum take a little bit back over in the cooking and the prepping of food so that she can have a bit more balance there and get for that girl to get that confidence back and be able to let somebody else handle the food. Otherwise, eating out would become increasingly more difficult. But I would say she would definitely need support in terms of kind of psychological and dietetic.
OK, and the good news is they are in touch with the GP about this. And you mentioned Bodywise, and we always say it's body and then why as in the question. So it's body, WHYS.ie.
And actually, sorry, they have another now website called bodywisebodyimage.ie, which has incredible resources in terms of carers, for teachers, for schools, but really, really good resources as well.
And that's important because we know how difficult it is for people to get support. So that might be a start.
Aveen Bannon and Dr. David Coleman from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, Ryan Tuberty spoke to John Hennigan in Hanoi in Vietnam. John's just become the first single Irish person to adopt a baby in the country. And he started by telling Ryan how he came to live in Vietnam.
So, briefly, Balana County Mio, and I'm living here for 5 years as a teacher, EEL teacher in British Vietnamese International School. So, yeah.
And of all the countries in all the world, you walked into Vietnam. Why?
Well, I lived in Korea, first of all, for 7.5 years, and I suppose I was looking for a change, and I had friends living in Vietnam before that, so I just said, why not try a different country? I travelled here, I suppose, about 10 years ago as well, I suppose I just fell in love with the country and the scenery and the people, and yeah.
And you like it? I've never been, so it strikes me as being kind of exotic and beautiful.
It is. It's just so, like, if you go to Hai Giang in the north and Da Nang Chang and Phu Quoc, there's just so much beauty in the country. And they do receive a lot of tourism as well. So it's very popular.
Okay, and can I ask you how old you are, John?
I'm 37.
37 years old. And are you in a...
I am indeed.
Are you in a relationship or you're not in a relationship?
I'm not. No, I'm single. Yeah.
And the reason I ask you that, exactly. I know. The reason I ask you that is not to be prurient and nosy, but it's part of our story this morning because you've made history as a single man in some ways in Vietnam. How old were you? Would you say, John, when you thought I'd love to be a dad?
I'd say like even from my early 20s, I've always sort of. I've always sort of loved the idea of adoption, and I've always really wanted. I couldn't see a life, I suppose, really without sort of a child in my life. You know, I suppose it gave me a sense of purpose or whatever. But I just always wanted one. I was, you know, wanted to provide a child with a loving, supportive home environment as well, and at the same time.
So you kind of decided, well, I'm in Vietnam. Let's start getting busy, taking it to the next level. Where do you begin?
Mm-hmm. Where do you begin? Absolutely. It's so as a single man, there are a certain number of restrictions as well in place. Like, so I was only allowed to adopt a male, so a boy, and my child had to have a certain disability. However, I think I got very lucky along the way. There were certainly a lot of obstacles, But I think because of COVID and other situations like that, you know, the International Adoption Authority here had more time in its hands, so they were able to kind of speed up the process a bit. I suppose here having a partner would mean doubling up on the paperwork, and you know, I would definitely run into a further complications if my partner was from a different nationality. But I was very lucky because I had a friend, Teresa Cormack, and from Tipperary out here, who started the process before me, and she sort of guided me through the whole thing, and I would be forever indebted to her. Mm.
And John told Ryan about some of the procedures he had to go through in order to adopt.
Yeah, Vietnam, I suppose, wanted a no objection letter from Ireland in order for them to proceed with assessing my suitability to adopt. And the Adoption Authority of Ireland wrote back saying that they have no knowledge of me or my circumstances. I can't really comment on my suitability to adopt here. However, and I was very lucky here, that they were able to provide me with a non-personalised letter outlining my legal position as an Irish citizen adopting abroad. It took a bit of time persuasion, but the Adoption Authority of Vietnam finally accepted it and moved on with the process.
And do you need Garda clearance as well, John?
Yeah, of course, from both countries, sure.
I'm struck by something you said there, that the child that you had to adopt had to be two things. One is male. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, I'm not really sure. That was just the information that was given to me.
And then the other point they said... The other point they said that it had to have a certain disability.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I know in Ireland... a cleft lip and a cleft palate is not regarded as a sort of disability for adoption, whatever. Like, but out here, it is. I suppose there's more weight placed in appearance and stuff, and so there's a lot more stigma on that. Like, but so I didn't really know what sort of disability my child would have. I suppose I was just kind of like, you know, I went through the process, and then I was. You know, I was matched with my son, who had a cleft lip and a cleft palate. Yeah.
And when did you meet your son for the first time?
So I met him. So after my dossier was accepted and approved or whatever by the Adoption Authority of Vietnam, I was then introduced to my child. Yeah, and so...
How was that for you?
It was unreal.
Yeah.
You know, when I entered the room, he had, before meeting him, I'd done a fair bit of research. And the advice out there was to kind of sit or stand from a distance and observe and not approach him straight away, So when I entered the room and in the orphanage, he had this big smile on his face. And I kind of like went against all the rule books, like, and approached him and played with him, you know, and picked him up. And, you know, I just couldn't believe the amount of energy that exuberated from him. And the fact he was really happy, I suppose, really comforted me.
Good.
Obviously, from that moment on, you built up all these sort of wild fantasies about your future together. And I felt, I don't know, quite optimistic about being able to adopt him later on.
And how old was he when you adopted him, John?
About 8 months,
okay.
Ryan, yeah.
And that was in September 2020, so you're in a slightly different level.
No, I didn't adopt him in September.
Oh, sorry, excuse me.
Yeah, well, so I adopted him on the 29th of January, so he was... so the first time I met him, he was 4 months old.
Ah, sorry, I see, okay. And how is he today, and how have you adjusted to your new life? I mean, you're a single man living in Vietnam, I presume, having the fun and do whatever, and then you wanted to change your life. How life changing has it been for you?
Yeah, oh God, it's happy. I hate to say it's not difficult, but you know, we're motoring on. He's so active and babbling the way the whole time. He started walking over there a week ago, so the energy levels have just stepped up a few gears. but honestly, we're doing grand. You know, he sleeps very well at night, which allows me to keep up with him during the day.
Yes.
And he's a great little appetite, so plenty of nice surprise in the nap every day.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, but he's,
welcome to the real world, John. So.
And John spoke about the name he chose for his adopted son.
Liam, yeah.
And why did you call him Liam?
Well, you know, I had a few names in my head first, and Liam wasn't there. But then I just went and visited him one of the times at the orphanage, and I don't know, something came into my head, Liam or whatever. And,
okay.
And I looked up online, and it suggested like a strong-willed warrior and protector.
Yeah.
And Liam is the Liam. So like, I wasn't really sure if I could have the Irish name on his birth certificate. I wasn't really sure because I was adopting domestically here in Vietnam, but you know, to register at home and everything, I wasn't really sure. So, but also like, so Liem in Vietnamese, L-I-E with a little kind of hat M.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I wasn't able to choose like Liam, L-I-A-M, I could choose the Vietnamese name, Liam.
Oh, that makes sense.
One, so.
That makes sense. They're both good meanings behind their names too. And tell me about the cleft palate. Is that something you're going to address, or are you going to leave him be, or what's the feeling?
No, so he's had his cleft. So he has his cleft palate surgery. He had that in March, but okay. The first one, so take you back to the first surgery.
Sure.
So after a few short days, I met him for the first time in September. I was already in contact with Operation Smile, who do fantastic work.
Mm-hmm.
They just changed children's lives, really. They're a non-profit organization set up by a couple in America, and the work they do is just phenomenal. But he underwent his first surgery on his cleft lip.
Yes.
In September, when he's about 4 months old now. It took a bit of persuasion, really, for Operation Smile, because generally a child has to be 6 months or above to be operated okay. on in Vietnam. Now, I researched, looked in international forums or whatever, and they kind of advised for the child to be operated in the first few months. So I was really eager to kind of try to get that in play. But we're so lucky that he was operated on the top surgeon in the hospital, Dr. Thai, and I'll be forever indebted to him. After 6 weeks, after I officially adopted him, then he underwent his second surgery, which was a cleft palate, again performed by the same surgeon. This was a lot more painful, though, and took a longer time to recover. But he still managed to get some food and milk down him. Perhaps when he's about 5 or 6, he'll meet with a speech pathologist to help him rectify any kind of speech impediments. We'll trust that time when it comes to it. But yeah, just really, I really want to highlight the amazing work that Operation Smile does. Like,
and
every 3 minutes, a child is born.
And that's free surgeries for children.
It's free surgery. It's the issue, I think, with it, like, is that some people, there's not, I suppose, enough awareness out there. Mm. So a lot of children grow up with cleft palate conditions and cleft lip conditions. And obviously there's a lot of, these children grow up feeling insecure, and obviously it affects their learning potential, job prospects, relationships. And so they just literally change lives. It's amazing, really, the work they do,
And can I ask you a little bit about the adoption thing in terms of, in Vietnam, a lot of children are left at places where the monks live. Is that right?
Yeah, in temples. So there's two sorts of orphanages systems, really. Like,
yeah.
there's one that's a government run orphanage, and they're financially supported and governed by the government. And these orphanages allow for children to be adopted internationally. And there are other privately run temples, really, like, who act as orphans, and these tend to be overcrowded, really, and a lot of the, they rely on the support of communities to keep them going. There's about 2 million orphans in the country here, and a lot of them are not adopted, really, because here in Vietnam, where there's a lot of waste, place, and blood, and they're like the bloodline, and they're suspicious of adopting a child who is non-relative to them. So, the prospect of them being adopted domestically is quite low, like, you know, likelihood.
So what's your plan now, John? You're a single man, dad with a baby boy, and you're in Vietnam, you're from Ba Na. So what's the plan? I mean, do you intend making a life in Vietnam for the immediate future, or would you like to come back to Mayo or back to Ireland?
I think it's a bit of both, really. I want my child, I want Liam to grow up bilingually. I want him to be familiar and know his culture quite well. But I also, and it's a constant fear that a lot of us who live internationally have, is that they're not exposed enough to probably Irish culture or whatever. So I do want to bring him back eventually, and expose him to Irish culture and get the same feel as I did, like, as a child.
That's John Hennigan on the Ryan Tubridy Show. And in the afternoon, every cloud, as they say, Margaret Kennedy called Katie Hannan on the live line to talk about a traumatic event that turned out to be a blessing in disguise.
It sounds daft, but, they inadvertently did me the biggest favour ever.
Okay, let's not tease people. We'll take them back and tell them what you're talking about. Tuesday, 15th of January, 2019. Where were you?
That's right. I was out. Myself and my partner were running a small dog minding and dog sitting business. And I was out with my youngest daughter out doing my customary dog walking. And we got a little delayed, so Paul ended up, we very rarely left the house at the same time, but Paul needed to do an errand, so he ran off to the bank. And when he arrived back, he phoned me, said, had I been home? I said, no, I'll be there in a couple of minutes. And he said, I think we've been burgled. And we had indeed. We pulled into the house, myself and Emily pulled into the driveway a couple of minutes later. I got out of the car, Paul was standing in the doorway. I just looked into the house and the very first thing I saw was a machete sitting on the stairs. Yeah, it was just horrendous, Katie. I mean, I felt violently sick. I just thought anything could have happened. That machete could have ended up in Paul. We had our own dogs and other dogs in the house. Anything could have happened. It just could have ended up so, so horrendous. We took our time and went through the house. We found a second knife up in one of my daughter's bedrooms. And it just really traumatised us both deeply.
Do you think now that Paul disturbed them? What had happened that they left they left the weapons behind?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. Paul arrived into the driveway and thankfully his mobile rang and he got out of the car and was walking around the garden talking on his phone before going into the house. It seemed when he got in, there were things dropped by the sliding patio doors. So it seemed like he was the thing that disturbed them and that they just took flight. That's what happened.
Right. Okay. So you called the guards, I presume?
We called the guards. They arrived at the house. They were just wonderful. They were absolutely wonderful. They were very kind and gentle with us. And they said, that they did. Paul was the brave one and asked the question, did they think the people would have been prepared to use those weapons? And the guard just said, absolutely, absolutely, you had a lucky escape.
And Margaret felt that the burglars were watching the house.
That's the sense I had, but then I didn't know if I was descending into paranoia at that. But I did feel it was very, very unusual that, between students, the dogs we were minding, and it was a busy house, and there were always people there. So it just seemed strange that it was literally less than half an hour the house was empty.
Right.
Was
it just you? Did you hear that maybe neighbours had been targeted as well?
Not that day, but in the past, yes, there had been. I mean, we'd been broken into in that house previously, but it was nothing like that. It was, somebody had come in, which is unpleasant. But this was just a very different feel, a different experience. You know, this was frightening.
Again, obviously, because you saw what they came armed with.
Yes, yes, exactly. And you know, you just we just have to feel huge relief that nobody was hurt, or none of the dogs had a knife put in them as well. I don't think I'd have got over that. Yeah. Either, you know.
But anyway, this had a massive impact on you personally, and on Paul, and on your daughter.
Absolutely. Huge, huge impact. I just felt I can't live like this. And you know, I woke up one of the nights and Paul was sitting there, I was sitting there, and I just said to him, within the back of our minds, we'd always kind of harbored the notion that one day we might go and live in France. And I just said to him, do you want to go and live in France? And he said, yeah. And
that was it.
We within a week we had paid a month's deposit on a house down near Perpignan on the border of France and Spain, without even seeing the house, without seeing the village, anything. But to be honest, we just felt anything has to be better than this, and we set the ball in motion. And a few short months later, we set sail with our two dogs and came over to live in France.
That's Margaret on the live line with Katie Hannon. And in the morning, Claire Byrne was looking at foreign travel.
Now, the government has maintained that things are still on track to resume international travel on the 19th of July, certainly within Europe, and that work is continuing on the EU digital COVID certificate. Now, this statement came following reports that it may not be ready in time. Last week, the European Commissioner for Justice confirmed that Ireland is the only EU member state that isn't ready to comply with the certificate for travel due to the cyber attack on the HSE. And I'm joined now by Owen Corrie, editor of Air and Travel magazine. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning, Claire.
What stage are we at with the digital COVID certificate?
Well, in one line, Europe has jumped it. We haven't. We've got exactly what you've said there. The officials are saying it will be ready. Mixed messages over the weekend by different government ministers. And not just over the weekend, in the run-up to this, we had different dates. Somebody talked about August, somebody talked about September. Strategically placed and leaked. It does look like that there is a little bit of foot-dragging going on, and we certainly have heard that with talk of 10-hour queues by Eamon Ryan. Even, you know, at the very beginning of the, at the airport, at the beginning of this, it's quite clear that with, before he'd even done his homework, Eamon Ryan was claiming the dog ate it. We are the absolute sceptics in terms of returning to international travel. Very unenthusiastic about it, while for the first time since the outbreak, the number of flights across Europe went back up over 50% of 2019 levels over this weekend.
Of course, the NEFL advice is, at the moment, only travel for essential reasons. So if that advice doesn't change on the 19th and the travel certificate comes into play, we might be in a difficult situation here as to whether we're allowed travel or not.
We're already in a difficult situation. As I said, nothing has changed. No essential travel until July the 19th, as far as the government is concerned.
Owen Corrie from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.